It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Chris Mosier has been a great athlete all his life, so it really wasn't a surprise when he took up triathlons, which is actually three sports in one. He's also a trans man, and when he qualified for the sport of duathlon, which is running and biking, for the 2016 Olympics, he became the first trans person to compete in an Olympic Games. It wasn't an easy road, and even when it was achieved, Mosier still didn't have an easy time. So what does this CrossFit decision mean to him and other trans athletes? Chris Mosier, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So the CrossFit decision, as I said a few minutes ago, was that in the 2019 CrossFit Games, people will be allowed to participate in as the gender that they see themselves as. What is your reaction to this?
This has been a long time in the making. I actually started a petition about this in 2014 when Chloe was first banned from CrossFit as after she was outed as a transgender woman.
Okay, so talk to me about who Chloe is.
So Chloe Johnson is a trans woman who was competing in CrossFit Games. She had been transitioned since her teenage years and had been living her life without telling folks that she was trans. Just living as the woman that she knows that she is and competing as a woman. And an anonymous person at her gym outed her as a transgender woman, which then made CrossFit respond and say that she was ineligible to compete, which started this whole rule about trans athletes only being able to compete in the gender that they were assigned at birth.
So CrossFit is changing their policy. What made them do that?
So it happened recently at the conference, the CrossFit conference, talking about 2019 games, where the CrossFit representative just said, this is the right move to do. This is the right way to treat our gym participants, our athletes. And it seems like it just came almost out of nowhere. I did not know that this was happening, that they were going to change the rule. And I keep pretty good tabs of this on my website, transathlete.com.
And is there a sense that the CrossFit is doing this? Now, CrossFit is a new sport, essentially. You have been involved in older sports. What's the conversation there? I mean, you were allowed to compete in the Olympics. How did that happen?
So I competed in the World Championship in 2016. Duathlon is not an Olympic sport, so World Championship is as high as I can go.
Got it. Okay.
In 2015, I made Team USA for the sprint duathlon, but at that time, I was ineligible to compete in the World Championship and any international competition because they follow the Olympic policy. And so I challenged the Olympic policy in 2015, which resulted in it being changed to allow trans athletes to participate with less restrictions. And that was the removal of the surgery requirement. So all the way up until 2015, transgender athletes were required to have a full lower surgery, internal and external genital modification, in order to compete in a sport, which is a human rights violation.
Right. And yes, to require somebody to change their body to compete. Yes. What is it that you argued and what made them listen in this case?
Well, it was exactly that. It was that no one should have to modify their body in order to participate in the sport. And for me as a trans man, I said, adding an extra body part is not going to make me a faster runner or a stronger cyclist. I competed in the national championship and made Team USA with all of the other male competitors at the starting line who made the team. And so, you know, I thought that I should be able to stand up and represent our country in the same way that the other men on the team could. And I think, you know, to be very honest with you, what I think was the determining factor here was that it was just the right time. It was, they needed an athlete with a name and a face that they could assign to the idea of a transgender athlete, because these policies are being made without ever speaking to trans people, without ever knowing who we are. And also, quite honestly, I think in this case, for my case versus Chloe Johnson and CrossFit, very much part of this was male privilege and the fact that I'm perceived as a straight white man. I'm not seen as a threat in sports because people believe that no one assigned female at birth could ever be competitive with men. And, you know, it was a very different situation than had we had a transgender woman trying to be the face of creating change. As we saw, it took extremely long in Chloe's case than CrossFit.
So that's an excellent point. I want to talk about transgender women, because that's part of the argument that people have said that that transgender women may have a competitive edge. Their bodies may be stronger. Science has disproven that, hasn't it?
Yeah, there are no studies out there. And also, we're not seeing transgender women that are in sports just dominating against women. It's just, you know, if that was the case, that we were going to field trans women and dominate in sports, it would have already happened. And it's just not, that's just not true. I know that there are a great range of abilities, of sizes, of strength within each gender as well. And so, you know, this is based off of a stereotype that everyone assigned male at birth is going to be bigger, faster, stronger than someone who was assigned female at birth. And we know that's a stereotype.
Hormones play a big part in this, and the Olympic policies reflect this, doesn't it?
Yes. So the Olympic policy and most elite-level policies, including actually the NCAA policy, which would be the start of where we start to see this policy, are based off of hormone status, and particularly testosterone.
Okay, so what is it that they're looking for in terms of testosterone?
So most of these policies are looking for the presence of testosterone. For me, as a transgender man, I take testosterone, and I will for the rest of my life in order to align my body more with how I feel inside. And for me, I had to get a therapeutic use exemption form through the World Anti-Doping Agency in order to compete in these international competitions. And essentially what that does is give me a range of testosterone that I'm allowed to be in, which is a quote-unquote typical male range, which as a side note is a huge range, even for cisgender men. And for transgender women, they're looking for the presence of testosterone. It needs to be below a certain level, and there needs to be testosterone blockers and estrogen treatment in order to sort of offset the hormonal balance that they have.
So there is a difference between being allowed to play, having the rules changing the rules, as you have been doing, and being welcomed to play. Talk to me about that.
Absolutely. I think that more and more people now know that trans athletes exist, but there is always pushback when we try to participate, and even more pushback when we start to win. I found that for myself, no one expected that I would win. And if I did win, I don't think that people thought that I would do it again. So as a trans man, I've had a pretty good time, even when I have won races. But we find that transgender women have, are discriminated against. And the media is particularly awful around covering their story just to even try to participate in sports, not even to have them win.
So talk to me about some of the things that media does.
Well, I think first of all is perpetuating these stereotypes. I think that there is a lot of drumming up of emotions around participation of transgender women. Right now we have a case in Connecticut where we have two transgender high school girls. And the way that people talk about them as though they are not people is what I find extremely frustrating. And I understand media needs to, you know, make sure that these stories are out there, but interviewing particular parents and putting out the negative connotations without ever correcting those is what is problematic.
Chris Mosier is an All-American and Hall of Fame athlete on Team USA. He is also a coach. He founded TransAthlete.com and is a transgender man. He was the first openly trans man to compete in the Olympics. And he joins us today in the wake of an announcement by CrossFit to allow people to compete in the gender category with which they identify. Chris, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, we're going to look at bankruptcy among older Americans. It's The Morning Show. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Life in the U.S. is a lot more expensive than it was 25 years ago. The social safety net is thinner, and the rate of people ages 65 and older filing bankruptcy is three times what it was in 1991. How does that feel to do everything you were supposed to do and still have to file bankruptcy? When do you have know that you have to do that? And then how do you go about it? We are taking your calls on this today. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email. And you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We want to know, are you going to have to file bankruptcy? Are you trying to put it off? Did you have to file bankruptcy? What was it about that that made you make that decision? Jonathan Ginsburg is a bankruptcy attorney at Ginsburg Law in Atlanta, Georgia. And he joins us this morning. Jonathan, welcome. Jonathan is not yet on the line. So we are taking your calls on this. We've been reading about and talking to Jonathan about the social safety net and how it has thinned out, how pensions have gone away so that people have less money in retirement than they did. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, so let's start with the basics in terms of filing for bankruptcy. What is personal bankruptcy? There are two kinds of personal bankruptcy, right?
That's correct. There are two types of bankruptcy. You have Chapter 7, which is basically designed to wipe out debt, typically credit card debt or medical debt. Then you have Chapter 13, which is a payment plan. It's a court-structured payment plan. And basically you pay over 3 to 5 years and either eliminate or completely reduce in total or some percentage of your debt.
So how common is bankruptcy in the U.S. right now?
Last statistics I saw, about 800,000 people file bankruptcy every year, and this is 2016 statistics. I looked up Wisconsin, so I know that's where you are. About 17,000 people filed bankruptcy in Wisconsin over the last year, approximately every year. Now, that compares to about 30,000 who filed maybe 2010. So it's been down. We're starting to see it go back up a little bit.
So it went up in 2010, I'm assuming because of the financial crash in 2008.
That's exactly right. And I think what's going to happen is that because the bankruptcy law is structured such that you can only file once every 8 years, what we think is going to happen is that people who filed in 2009, 2010 are going to be filing again. Because sometimes the same problems that existed when they originally filed are going to recur, and they're going to be able to file again 2018, 2019. So I wouldn't be surprised to see it go back up.
Okay, so what are some of the things that were occurring that made them file to begin with and that might make them file again?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. I think obviously the big one that causes bankruptcy is medical debt. We have insurance that doesn't cover nearly as much. If people who are older, if they have Medicare or Medicaid, that doesn't cover as much. There's prescription costs out of pocket. That is a big problem. I've seen a lot of problems with co-sign debt. For some reason, there's a lot more people co-signing for each other, and creditors will get folks to basically indebt themselves for other people. Somebody can't pay, and then the whole thing kind of collapses like a house of cards. Everybody gets sued. That becomes a real problem. So those are some of the things.
Is this most of this co-signed debt, especially for older people, for their kids?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing a lot of creditors, and student loans is a real big example. 15, 20 years ago, I never saw student loan debt being co-signed. Now it's very common. You have even something called parent plus loans, where schools or financial aid offices ask people to get their parents to co-sign their debt. And so when the kid can't pay or the debt becomes too large, they go after the parents. So that's definitely a big problem.
We were talking to Jonathan Ginsburg about bankruptcy in retirement. Three times as many people are going into bankruptcy today as they were in 1991. Three times as many people over 65. Jonathan, let's talk about common myths of bankruptcy. What do people think about filing for bankruptcy, and what are the realities?
I think the biggest myth that I see is that bankruptcy is some sort of a moral failing. Bankruptcy is an economic tool, and if you have a situation where you simply can't pay your debt, that's a business problem. That's not a moral failing. I think a lot of people, especially older Americans, have been brought up to believe that you pay your debts, which, of course, you should pay your debts. But sometimes if you can't, you need to look at the options. Instead of rating your 401k, for example, that's a big mistake because 401ks are typically, or IRAs, retirement plans, are protected in bankruptcy. If you do that, if you rate it, you're going to get rid of your retirement money to pay credit card debt. That doesn't make any sense. That's a big mistake, something I see a lot of people make. Digging the hole deeper as opposed to just saying, okay, we've got a problem, we've got to come up with a solution to it. And, of course, bankruptcy is not the only option. There are other options as well.
We are taking your calls on personal bankruptcy as you age. Are you over 60? Have you filed for bankruptcy? Do you think that you might need to file for bankruptcy? And what puts you in this position? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Morning. So you just said bankruptcy is not the only option. What are the other options?
I think one thing that I do a lot of with older people is I call it the drop-dead letter strategy. Basically, if someone has no source of income and they have, or Social Security is their only source of income, they have very little in terms of assets, you can basically tell creditors, go away, because Social Security money is not something that can be garnished. Even if it's in your bank account, they can't garnish it. So if all you have is Social Security money coming in, what I do is I write the creditors a letter saying, look, my client's elderly or ill, has no source of income other than Social Security, no assets. Mark this as an uncollectible debt and go away. And many times that's enough. I've done that. In fact, I did this two weeks ago for somebody. Basically just said, look, we don't need to file bankruptcy. Let's just tell these creditors that you're not in collectible status. Leave you alone, and many times they do, if we can provide evidence of it. Plus, by writing this letter, I take the pressure off because they're not calling the debtor, they're calling me. I basically say, we can't pay you. They say, okay, they call me every 6 months, and the creditor does calls me every 6 months, and I say, no, can't help you. And it basically just goes away.
And this is if a person is only getting Social Security. If they're getting a pension from their job, is that protected too?
That's protected too. Anything that is that's a tax protected type of account, and again, state law is going to vary, but most places, most states, pension money is going to be protected as well. So I think that depending on where you live, you should find out whether or not the money you've got coming in is in some way protected. Again, if it's an IRA, a 401k, Social Security, most pensions, there's a good chance it's going to be protected. But that's certainly a question to ask, because if it is protected, you just basically tell the creditor, I can't pay you. You have nothing you can do to me. You want to make sure your bank accounts are, your banks know that this is protected money, or you segregate your money in a protected account by telling your bank that this is money that they can't touch. And basically, the creditors can't do anything about it. If you tell them that, they will go away. They know this, but they don't always, they're not going to tell you.
Yeah, the creditor industry, and I actually misunderstood you a minute ago. I thought you said predator industry, because if you've ever been on the other end of those calls, it does feel kind of predatory. When did that kind of mushroom into such a lucrative industry?
Well, I think one of the things that's really incredible, if you think about it, is there's an entire industry of buying stale debt. You know, when you have debt, there's a certain period of time called the statute of limitations where you cannot collect on debt. So basically it becomes old. For example, most credit card debt, depending on the state, after 6 years, the debt is no longer collectible. Yet companies, large companies, publicly traded companies, will buy debt that is 10 years old, 12 years old. They'll buy for pennies on the dollar. They will write letters to people saying, you owe this money, pay it. And, of course, some people get the letter, they're intimidated, and they pay it. Or some places, if you pay even $5 on the debt, you revitalize it.
So once you pay anything on the debt, then that 6 years starts right over again.
That's exactly right. So, you know, I think a lot of people, and again, especially elderly folks or older people who are trained, brought up to pay their bills, they get a letter, a threatening letter from something that looks really official, and they say, well, what's the harm of paying $10 or $15? Well, it could be a big harm. But that's something that you know, we see a lot. They call it zombie debt is the term for it. Mm. And debt that is no longer collectible becomes all of a sudden revitalized because somebody makes a payment on it, or because, again, some creditor decides, a debt buyer gets it and decides to collect on it. So Those are some things that, that really affect older people because they don't necessarily know that they don't have to pay it.
So how long have you been practicing bankruptcy law?
About 30 years.
So talk to me then. I'm glad you said that. So talk to me then about the changes. Was there always this industry that tried to trick people and intimidate people and bully people into making money on old debts?
I think that's more of a more recent phenomenon. I think obviously things have become very computerized. And when debts are bought and sold, of course, when it was commoditized, I think debts are bought and sold as secured instruments. That made it a lot more lucrative. And you have companies, again, very big publicly traded companies that you know, normally service regular common type of debt. They get into this zombie debt industry because it's so profitable. If you think about it, if you can buy debt at 2 to 5 cents on the dollar, and then you know, collect on it and get 15 or 20%, then you're making a lot of money. If you have shareholders that are getting, are making a lot of money, they're going to be pretty happy about it. So that's more something I've seen in the last 10, 15 years.
Jonathan Ginsburg is a bankruptcy attorney at Ginsburg Law in Atlanta, Georgia. He's taking us through the debt, bankruptcy balloon for people who are older. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. After the financial meltdown in 2008, a lot of people found themselves filing for bankruptcy. Their retirement savings gone, but now even 10 years later, bankruptcy rates are still high and going up, especially among older people. Are you one of them? Was what making this decision hard for you? Did it seem inevitable? Have you filed bankruptcy in the past, and what was that like? Did you co-sign your children's student loans, and now that has backfired on you? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jonathan Ginsburg is an attorney at Ginsburg Law in Atlanta, and he is talking us through this bankruptcy, especially for older people. Jonathan, do you see bankruptcy in younger people now as well?
I do. I think that it really, financial crisis can happen to anybody at any age. It can happen very quickly. One of the things that I think that we all see is people can go from being solvent and paying their bills to totally insolvent within a matter of a month or two because of an illness or a job loss or a cutback. So it can happen very, very quickly. Things have really accelerated. That's a real trend that I've seen over the years. And also I think that people have less family support. They don't have other folks they can turn to when there is a crisis. So, yes, these are all factors that make things can make things go bad very quickly for people of any age.
So there is the emotional issue of bankruptcy. You are not simply a cut and dried attorney. You have to deal with people who come into your office and cry.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're attorneys and counselors at law. And the counseling part may be to really sit with somebody for, a half hour, an hour, and really kind of walk through what they need to do. And I think with bankruptcy, one of the things I've noticed is that it may take 3 or 4 appointments before somebody decides, it's time for me to do this. You never want to push anybody to go into bankruptcy. I wouldn't want to do it. I wouldn't want my relatives, my friends to do it. But sometimes it's necessary. And I think sometimes you have to emotionally get there and mentally get to the point where you say, this is something that I need to do for economic reasons, but get past the guilt, get past the shame and the embarrassment. Those are some of the factors that do come into play, absolutely.
So we talked at the very beginning about the factors that have changed in the last 30 years. Medical costs are on the rise, and even if you have Medicare, you are still paying out of pocket. Is that a large part of why older people come to you?
Yeah, I think so. I think that medical bills are a big thing. I think that there's a big gap in terms of prescriptions. You probably heard of the donut hole.
Yes.
People have prescriptions and they can't pay. They're obligated to pay a bigger part of those prescriptions. I think for older people, the employer-provided health plans are less and less. There's not as many companies that offer pensions for full retirement, and they get on a pension, and the medical medical component is reduced, or they're asked to take a reduction. I see that a lot. A number of people who have worked for companies and they're getting a nice pension, and then all of a sudden the company calls up and says, we're having financial difficulty. We're going to cut what we pay you. We're going to cut your medical benefits. So I think that the more of the burden for medical costs has fallen on individuals. And, of course, an older person doesn't have the option of getting a second job many times to kind of cover that gap.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it can become a real problem, again, very quickly.
And it's not just companies that are trying to renege on their pensions now. It's states that are doing that. We're seeing this play out in Illinois.
Yes, absolutely. I think that states, you know, they've overpromised what they can pay, mm-hmm. or the investments have not done well, or they invested with Bernie Madoff, or whatever the case may be. And then, again, the workers, retired workers, who thought they were set for life or had a baseline for life are now seeing that that baseline is now two-thirds of what it was. And it's something that is very discouraging to people. And you see people, there have been suicides over that.
Right.
Because I think a lot of folks don't want to be a burden to their kids or they have no place to go. And it can be pretty unforgiving out there. It's very tough out there.
So what is it that made it unforgiving and tough over the span of your career?
I just think that things move a lot faster now. I think that number one, we have a lot more hidden inflation. In fact, there was a New York Times article about elderly bankruptcy for the elderly, and one of the comments was, you know, the economists who say that there's no inflation are wrong. Things are going up. So I think that costs creep up, $5, $10. If you think about it, 20 years ago, you didn't have a $200 cell phone bill or a cable bill.
Mm-hmm.
So there's new costs that have come into play where everybody has them, and then all of a sudden, you know, the budget doesn't balance. So I think that's one of the things that there's sort of hidden inflation going on. I think that, again, things move very, very quickly. If you get in trouble, it can be very easy to go from being in a little trouble to a lot. You know, for example, if you have a credit card debt and you're paying, let's say the interest rate is 8% and you miss a payment and you're late by a day, that can jump up to 28% with a $35 or $45 penalty. So you go from being, you know, solvent with a credit card debt you can manage to one where you're in penalty phase. And the penalty cost can be just outrageous. And so, again, it can go from being, you know, where you have it managed and you're under control, you miss one payment and the whole, it sort of becomes a downhill, it starts to roll downhill so that you really can't control it. So that can be a big problem. Again, I just think things happen much faster. That's the thing that I've seen. People will call me and say, you know, I was doing fine up until about 2 months ago. Now everything's just completely gone off the rails. So that is definitely a trend.
So a few years ago, there was the advent of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That has mm-hmm. been pretty much gutted from the inside during the Trump administration. But did it help with this in any way?
I think a little bit. I mean, again, the CFPB definitely made creditors think a little bit because there was some conduct that was, you know, that was definitely prescribed on that. I do think that it has been gutted. I think that there's not as much fear about that anymore. And realize that if you're a creditor or a collection agency, and again, not all creditors are bad. They're doing what they're trying to collect on debts. But, you know, the conduct that they engage in, they don't have a lot of repercussion. There's just not much that they're afraid of on a big scale. And I think the Federal Bureau, you know, the CFPB was really designed to go after some of these large institutions and big, almost class action type of things. And I think the fear of that is gone.
You deal with these creditors a lot. I mean, what is your personal feeling here? Should this be something that there should be sort of legal repercussions to? Should people should creditors be limited to how much they can threaten people?
Well, there is a law. I mean, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, or FDCPA, is out there that does limit what creditors, bill collectors can do, not the underlying creditors, but bill collectors for the most part. But the problem is if you sue under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, you're limited to $1,000 in damages, statutory damages, plus actual damages, which if you can prove that, and sometimes attorney's fees. Well, are you going to go to federal court for $1,000? You know, probably not.
Right.
So it's, you know, the law, the way the law has been structured, and realize that you know, credit card companies and banks, they pay lobbyists millions of dollars to go to Congress to limit their liability. So for an individual to go after, you know, ABC credit card company or collection agency, you know, it's a costly type of thing. Then can you collect against it? Because, again, some collection agencies are legit. Some of them are not. And so, you know, if I'm going to take a case, you know, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, I've got to hope that I can prove actual damages. which is, you know, again, can be very speculative. How were you really harmed? Can I get attorney's fees?
Right.
I'm going to get $1,000 in statutory damages. Is it worth going to federal court over that? Probably not.
And there's no other recourse. There's no other protection for people.
Not really. I mean, some states have consumer protection bureaus. A lot of the consumer protection is sort of designed to be in a class action phase. You probably heard about the big Wells Fargo settlement that came out last week, where they were, you know, kind of some shenanigans with mortgages. But a lot of the class action stuff is of course, going to enrich lawyers, class action lawyers.
Right.
It doesn't really do a lot for the individual person damaged. And, yes, again, there are some remedies under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act or Fair Credit Reporting Act, but you've got to really show some significant damages to make that worthwhile, because it's hard to find a lawyer to take one of those cases. Because, again, for $1,000 to go to federal court, you know, you'll do it. I mean, you can do it, but it's not necessarily the easiest thing to find somebody to do that.
We are talking to Jonathan Ginsberg. He's an attorney in Atlanta, and he specializes in bankruptcy law. We're talking specifically about bankruptcies for older Americans. Are you one of them? Are you considering bankruptcy? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. We want to know that the process that you're thinking through as you go through bankruptcy, and how that sort of maybe clashes with the signals that you've gotten all your life about if you do things right, then you will end up okay. Jonathan, I want to talk a little bit about that. If you do things right, is there a right way to do things anymore?
Well, again, I think it's more about protecting yourself. And again, I think that there's a disconnect maybe between what you feel in your heart, the emotions of what you should do, and the economics of it. If you're faced with, you know, a creditor calling up saying you're a bad person because you're not paying this bill, you know, do you have the inner strength to say to that person, you know, economically, it's more important for me to buy my medicine than to pay, you know, a credit card debt? So, you know, making some of those very difficult choices and saying, you know, I've got to do what's right for me, that, you know, what is the right thing? You know, is it right to pay your bills that you incurred, or is it right to say, I'm going to buy medicine to cover myself and my spouse? You know, what is right? And that's something I can't necessarily answer. As a bankruptcy attorney, I tell my clients, I'm looking at this from an economic point of view. What makes the most sense for you economically? How do we protect you? How do we make sure that you have money going down the road, that 5 years from now you're not coming back to me saying, I'm in the same boat? And so it can mean some very, very difficult choices, and somebody doesn't get paid sometimes. And if that somebody is a credit card company, to me, that's a better decision than to say, I'm not going to buy medicine.
We are talking to Jonathan Ginsberg about bankruptcy, and Ginsberg is a bankruptcy attorney in Atlanta. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment. It's the Ideas Network. We're talking about bankruptcy this hour on the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're especially talking about bankruptcy for people over 60, over 65, nearing retirement, or maybe having to put retirement off. Bankruptcy for people that age is three times higher than it was in 1991. We're exploring a little bit of what is driving this and how people feel when they have to declare for bankruptcy after trying to do everything right. 800-642-1234 is the number to call us at. Ideas@WPR.org is the place to email us. We've got some calls here, Jonathan Ginsberg. Gary from Brookfield, welcome to the program.
Hello, Gary. Hello to your guests. I just want to preface this by saying that I had a career that spanned the late 60s through the teens, 2000 teens, and I always had high-profile jobs in southeastern Wisconsin, where I worked with the people in the C-suite and ended up there at the end. And I think that there was a big change and the thinking and mentality of those guys. Back in the 70s and the 60s, you had guys who served in World War II, and they felt that they needed, there was an obligation for them to provide some sort of retirement for their workers. That disappeared in the 80s and 90s, and went under the guise of, we as corporations don't want to be paternalistic. And that was an evolution in the leaders of corporations. But not just corporations, but governments also, and service industries. And I think that's a big part of where we are now.
Thank you very much for that, Gary. There was a very famous movie in the 1980s, Jonathan Ginsberg, where the line was, greed is good. Did that kind of become our mantra?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, there's a real emphasis on corporate profits. And I think that, you know, the caller is absolutely right. I think that the sense that a company should provide for its retired employees is over. I think there's really... you know, the safety net, as it were, whether it's by government or by companies, has really fallen much more on the actual worker as opposed to the entity.
And
no question about it.
The safety net from companies, but what about the safety net from governments?
You know, I think government is just, they don't have money either. And I think that they are really, there's just, the safety net is really shrinking. I think there's a perception that we don't have enough money, and that the obligations that we've put into place for older folks, those obligations are negotiable now. People are living longer, and there's just not enough tax money coming in. I mean, I do, besides bankruptcy, I do a lot of Social Security disability work, and we see in that area, too, that there's just simply a sense that there's only a certain amount of money to go around, and we're just going to cut benefits until the budget balances.
We are taking your calls, talking about bankruptcy today, 800-642-1234. Chris from Brookfield, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. Why is it that businesses can go into bankruptcy and it's called good business, and then a lot of people get hurt? Whereas if an individual goes into bankruptcy, there's a super negative stigma.
Jonathan?
First of all, I think very good question. I think, first of all, with businesses, most of the time or many times they go into what is called Chapter 11, which is a reorganization. And it's a way for the business to shed obligations. Sometimes it can be pensions. Sometimes it can simply be debt. And it's simply seen as an economic tool. And as I said before, for individuals, we need to think of it as an economic tool. I think the stigma is self-made. I don't think or self-created. I don't think that there should be a stigma. If you have to do it, you have to do it. So, you know, for individuals, you know, most people prefer to follow Chapter 7, where they can wipe out debt, or Chapter 13, which is the repayment plan, is much more difficult to do. But for a business, it's just seen as an economic tool, and I think that that's simply, again, something that the individual should see it as an economic tool as well.
We are talking about bankruptcy, and calls are coming in. Judy from Manitowoc, welcome to the program.
Hello, Carrie and Mr. Ginsberg. My question was that the city is redoing my street. They're reconstructing it, and they are reconstructing the gas and water mains. And everyone in the neighborhood where this is happening got a letter yesterday that said that we will have to pay up to $7,000 if our water main pipes are made of lead, because they want to replace them with plastic or copper. And they said if your pipe is already plastic or copper, you wouldn't have to pay anything. And I found it interesting. I was listening, and Mr. Ginsberg say that you could have your bank protect you from your accounts being garnished. And I am 73, and I'm collecting, I have Social Security and a pension. So would I, if I go to my bank and ask them to protect me, my accounts, from any garnishing, would that hold true for the city if they wanted to garnish for that? Because that's quite an exorbitant amount, and they're offering a payment system, you know, but I just feel it's
right.
Too much. I may have the right kind of pipes, but...
Right. Yeah. Judy, thank you very much for that. Jonathan?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, again, I don't know about this particular situation, but generally speaking, I would think that Social Security money is pretty much protected. The only people that don't get the protection or that are not subject to it would be the IRS, certainly, and the federal government. I think that most state governments probably would be subject to that. Again, I think that would be a function of law in, I guess, it's Wisconsin state law. But I would go to the bank and say, look, you know, this is money that is Social Security money or it's pension money, and this needs to be marked. This account needs to be marked as such. But that's a question I would find out. Again, I don't want to offer legal advice on the radio, but I think certainly a lawyer local can answer that question and find out very quickly whether that money would be protected from the city for that utility repair. My guess, my hunch would be that it would be. And again, I think that you want to make sure the bank knows that and has protections in place. And I wouldn't say the bank's going to protect you. You've got to protect yourself, but you need to let the bank know that they could potentially face liability if they don't honor the bar against the garnishment or a levy for Social Security or pension money.
Thank you for that, Judy. Shouldn't the city be paying for utility replacement? I mean, you know, it was their laws that created these old pipes to begin with.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point. Again, I think every city is going to have its own rules about that, own laws about that. But, you know, this is another example of passing on an economic burden to people, you know, who are affected by it. That may be more of a political consideration than something that's more of a debt creditor type of thing. But, you know, that's certainly something where your local elected representatives might get a phone call and say, you know, why are we being on the hook for this when we had nothing to do with placement of these lead pipes? So I think this is where, you know, it's certainly worth making some phone calls, finding out. I think that's really a kind of an overriding point here. You got to know. You can't sit back and wait for things to happen. You've got to be proactive. You've got to find out. In this lady's case, you know, find out, you know, is she really responsible for this, you know, this large burden? Is there any option to avoid that? Is there any sort of exemption? In many cases, there could be for an elderly person.
Right.
Is there any protection that she's got from her money against the city or the county? These are all questions that need to be asked.
Okay, we're going to go to another caller. Yeah. We've got a couple minutes left. Yeah. Donald from Chilton, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
My wife passed away in March. And supposedly she owes like $15,000 for a Social Security overpayment. And they said that was fine. And then they give me her, you know, survivor benefit, like $218. And now they say I owe it all.
Okay, so we have very little time. I'm so sorry that your wife died and this is happening to you. Jonathan, can you address this in about 30 seconds?
Yeah, I don't think that you would owe it, but I don't know. That's a... You know, again, I have not researched that, but I don't think you know it.
Okay, so Donald, call a lawyer and find out, because you just had a lawyer tell you that this doesn't sound about right. Jonathan Ginsburg is an attorney at Ginsburg Law in Atlanta, Georgia. He has been taking us through why so many older Americans are filing for bankruptcy 3 times as much as many people have filed for bankruptcy than they did 25 years ago. Jonathan, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
I'm Carrie Kaufman, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.